this is under serious threat. The values of the Enlightenment are under serious threat in society generally and in universities in particular. And we really have to take this very seriously now. And if we don't act now and fight back against this, we won't have any free speech or any ability to discuss ideas at all anymore in society.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Freedom Feature. And I'm your host, Barry Bussey. With me today, I have Frances Widdowson. And Frances is an academic who has been involved in some controversy of late. And we want to have a look at her expertise, her academic writings, who she is, and also what is causing all the uproar. So stay tuned. Frances, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Frances, it's great to have you with us. And I'm just wondering if you could share with our audience your background and your study, your expertise.
Yes. So I have been involved in the university system for quite some time. I did my master's degree at the University of Victoria in 1990. Then I worked for the government of the Northwest Territories in starting in 1992, where I met Albert Howard, who was the co-author of a number of books and articles that I wrote. Then, because of my difficulties with the government of the Northwest Territories in speaking about the traditional knowledge policy, which was concerning Indigenous, what's called Indigenous traditional knowledge, I decided to go back into the academy because I thought that would be the area that I could speak the truth about these various issues that I was seeing in the Northwest Territories. I did my PhD at York University. My supervisor was Leo Panitch, who was one of the most famous socialists in Canada. And fortunately, I met him because although he didn't agree with me about my ideas, he was a true academic, and he said that you have enough evidence here to go forward, to put your ideas into the mix for debate, which allowed me to get my PhD. And then a couple of years later, after having various teaching posts, I got a job at Mount Royal University in 2008. And then I was there until 2021 when I was canceled. So that has been my background in the academic area.
Well, let me just do a plug for your supervisor there on your PhD. It seems to me that that was one of the great hallmarks of classical liberalism, the idea that you would be willing to allow another person to speak and to be able to present their views on the facts as they found them, even if it was going against the norm, as it were. And the fact that your supervisor allowed you to do that, to me, is, I tip my hat to that person, because that's the kind of thing we need in this country. In fact, in the world, we have seen classical liberalism do wonderful things. In fact, it has given us a lot of, a lot of freedom over the years. And the advance of our civilization is due in no small part to this idea of allowing free speech.
Yes. And it's the Enlightenment. That's the big thing that people have to realize, that it's a major development in humanity that we had the Enlightenment, where you didn't have to rely upon tradition or revelation or any kind of authority. And you could, through reason, decide for yourself as an individual whether you thought something was true or not. And that was a very freeing type of development that occurred. And this is under serious threat. The values of the Enlightenment are under serious threat in society generally and in universities in particular. And we really have to take this very seriously now. And if we don't act now and fight back against this, we won't have any free speech or any ability to discuss ideas at all anymore in society.
Yeah, and of course, the other element of the Enlightenment that I also appreciated was the fact that it also allowed those who had a religious point of view as well as a secular view to be able to come and to discuss and use their reason and try to determine the nature of things. I think of some of the great Enlightenment thinkers, such as John Locke. I think of Sir Isaac Newton, who both themselves were very religious, but yet were also very much willing to get engaged in debate. And that was that and allow the freedom of speech and allow the ability to be able to engage. And it's that lack of engagement that I think is very much a concern today. And here it is. Now, can you just let us know exactly what you were studying that was so controversial?
So what I was studying concerned Indigenous policy. So that is my area of expertise. Albert Howard and I, in 2008, wrote a book together called Disrobing the Aboriginal Industry, The Deception Behind Indigenous Cultural Preservation. And my dissertation, which was just published actually in 2019, Separate but Unequal, How Parallelist Ideology Conceals Indigenous Dependency. So these two books, and they're the same kind of theoretical orientation, were very much going against the grain of what is now sort of the dominant view about Indigenous policy, which is what's called parallelism. So parallelism is the dominant position, which is that in order for Indigenous people to overcome their disadvantage, they should be granted sovereignty. They should become a parallel society or parallel societies with non-Indigenous societies, and neither should interfere in the operations of others. And that really started, I guess, to become on stream in a major way in the 1990s with the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples. And the big kind of point of contention is this idea of development, cultural development, and what is called the theory of uneven and combined development, which talks about what happens when you have societies of very different levels of development coming together and the kinds of sort of interactions that happen. And this concerns the fact that Indigenous societies are rooted in a hunting and gathering mode of production. They've obviously become modern in the sense that they use technology that is modern, but many of the cultural attributes are still kind of rooted in the traditional patterns. And what happens when those sorts of cultural features come into contact with much more developed ones, which have things like writing and working by the clock instead of working by the task in terms of economic processes, and then political ones, what's called legal rational authority. So that's when authority is derived from the office that you hold, not from the fact that your parent or your ancestors had this kind of political position within society, like the monarchy. So the monarchy is a more traditional form than, you know, modern liberal democratic systems where you elect someone, and once you elect someone, it's understood that that person has authority because of their elected position. When they're not elected anymore, they don't have that authority. So those kinds of sort of cultural sort of features are not present in hunting and gathering cultures. And it makes it very, very difficult for Indigenous people to participate in modern societies when they continue to retain those cultural features which are rooted in the hunting and gathering mode of production. So that was a very controversial position in the 90s. Okay. And that's kind of where we're at now, is that now you're not allowed to put forward that position anymore. You used to be able to put forward that position. You can't do it anymore in the university system.
Okay. So help me to understand. I'll see if I understand exactly how this works. And so you have parallel systems. You allow the Indigenous people to carry on their traditional way of life, separate and distinct from why would I say the European traditions is
or you know, it can be, it doesn't have to be European, because you have, you know, Japan, for example, has become liberal democratic, and not so much China, but you do have Asian societies that have adopted enlightenment values and institutions, and this legal rational authority, which is very, very important in political systems. So it's really what would be considered to be modern societies. So modernity is the word that is generally used, as opposed to traditional societies.
Okay. So the idea of in the 1990s was that we go on this two-track system, parallel system, or parallel understanding of the relationships. Okay.
Yes.
So now this was a position that you argued for in your work?
No, I was a critic of it, and Albert Howard and I were critics of it. So we were criticizing it because we were saying that sort of understanding didn't really consider the differences in development that existed between indigenous and modern societies. People were kind of conceptualizing it similar to like how Quebec interacts with the rest of Canada. But Quebec is a modern society. It speaks French, but you know, there's no difficulty in interacting, having Quebec interact with Alberta. It's a very similar level of development. But if you have, for example, these remote communities and pretending that they're somehow nation states interacting with Canada, that doesn't deal with many of the huge problems that exist due to the dependent character of these small, isolated societies. So it's not really recognizing those problems and just transferring money to those small, isolated groupings without any kind of developmental strategy is resulting in the terrible social conditions that we're seeing in many of these remote communities today.
So as I hear you talk, I think of other groups who also do not fit the modern mold, although they do use modern technology. And I'm thinking, for example, religious groups such as the Old Order Mennonites, the Amish, the Hutterites. They kind of are in their own communities doing their traditional way of life and so forth. They are interacting economically with the rest of the community. How do you distinguish those kinds of communities in this parallel concept? Or is this something that it's apples and oranges, it doesn't fit?
It has some similarities and some differences. So the similarities are that they are kind of parallel societies to some extent. The difference is that these groups, when they came to Canada, they came to Canada. So they already had it in their understanding of how things were going to be, that they were going to form these distinct kind of entities. And they kind of carved out ways of living that, probably are on the way out. So it's not as it's similar in that you do have these parallel societies. It's different in that, first of all, they are more developed, those societies. They came from Europe and they had already Iron Age technology and writing and all these sorts of things in their in their heritage. So it's more developed anyway. But the situation is quite different in that they kind of carved out their way of life in this context when they were moving from one area to another. And that is something that can be done, you know, not easily, but at least you have people who are thinking about how to do that. In the case of indigenous populations, they had sort of another society thrust upon them and organized according to the sort of the logic of the colonizer. And because of that, you know, became dependent on the colonizer. So all these communities that have been formed that are supposed to be what they call nations, which is not a very good term to call them. They're really bands or tribes, perhaps. They have now taken a position as dependent, completely dependent, economically dependent, with not really any kind of integrity of their own that fits in any way with sort of the modern society. So it's a much more difficult kind of project in terms of the indigenous communities. And so in the case of these religious minorities that you know, figured out how to be productive. So those communities are productive. They do produce the food that they need, and they have various kinds of educational processes that they engage in. In the case of indigenous communities, those are completely reliant on transfers in order to survive. Like they're not productive in any way. They're basically transfer economies. And so they're reliant on, you know, various forms of welfare and payments of various kinds. They aren't contributing in any way to sustaining themselves, with the exception of a certain amount of hunting and gathering type of activities does happen. But that's a very minor part of their societies.
Okay. All right. So I was just going to mention that. So your position is what exactly as to how you alleviate or deal with this situation of trying to help these communities to be able to be, are you looking for them to be self-sustaining? What is the argument or the positions that your research has taken you?
So the main thing is educational types of development, which are necessary. So what's really needed, though, is wider than that, is kind of a developmental strategy. So you have this gap in development that exists, which is resulting in people, if they moved out of their communities and went to another location, it would be very traumatic and difficult because people wouldn't be able to just get a job and, you know, become part of the urban, you know, environment or anything like that. We sort of take it for granted that, you know, if you can't get a job in Calgary, you move to Toronto and you figure something out there. That's not an option for people in these remote communities because they don't have those kinds of skills and attitudes to be able to do that in a strange location. So tremendous amounts of thought has to be given to how to deal with this problem. But until it's recognized as a problem, this developmental situation, nothing can be done to address it. So at this point, in terms of the critique of the existing system, it is really about saying, look, this is not really understanding what's going on at all in these communities, because it's basically taboo to talk about the nature of hunting and gathering cultures and the difficulties that people who retain those features have in participating in a modern society. So it really is not something that can be talked about very easily. And until we recognize that, we can't really figure out any sort of policy direction to solve that. And what's happening now is people are saying, the dominant view of it is saying that, you know, indigenous societies, it's really colonialism which has caused this dependency. And so if you just remove sort of the colonial oversight, then these communities will become vibrant entities and be able to kind of take their place in terms of their interaction with modern society. But that doesn't understand it very well.
Okay, so then is this now the position of, for example, the current federal government, is to allow these communities to just, you know, they have to excuse my absolute ignorance of how all of this works and the whole debate. And for those who are listening, the reason why we're interested in this story is simply because this is a very controversial situation that Francis, who's a professor, is in. And the question we got to be asking ourselves as a country moving forward with these and many other issues with respect to public debate and discussion, we need to have free speech. And so that's extremely important, and to allow someone like Francis to be able to have the opportunity to be able to express these views, even though there appears to be a lot of opposition. And what we want to do is to be able to encourage speech, because we want to ensure that as a country, we're able to move ahead and not just be caught up with political correctness and identity politics and all the rest of it. We want to be able to help resolve problems. And it seems to me that if we are not able to discuss these issues, we're not going to be able to resolve problems. So that's where we're coming at. And Francis, I just trying to, because of my lack of knowledge of this whole thing, and just really trying to understand what all is happening in this area. And, you know, we hear often about the various needs and concerns of First Nations communities across the country. And we're always, I think Canadians have a lot of sympathy towards these people and want them to succeed and want them to be able to flourish. And in your years of experience, you're saying that, well, it's this particular mindset that we have with respect to the kind of idea of a pluralistic systems. And is this understanding something that is embedded as well within the First Nations community, as well as the academic community? I mean, where does this fit?
So my experiences with the academic side, and to be honest, I haven't for a number of years, probably since 2000s, actually done specific research now. Like I did research in the 90s and the 2000s, wrote these books, and then got somewhat diverted into just examining, which we'll get into. You mentioned identity politics and political correctness. That's where it's taken me now, because what happened is that I couldn't put forth those arguments with respect to Indigenous policy and started trying to figure out why that was the case. And it turned out that there is this kind of way of thinking about things in universities, which is now seeping into the rest of society, which is colloquially referred to as wokeism, which is basically identity politics that has become totalitarian. That's the nature of wokeism. Anyway, wokeism argues that in order to enable groups that are oppressed to overcome their oppression, you have to affirm how they perceive themselves. That is a key for them overcoming their oppression. And what that means is if you're critical of their view, you don't think it's true, and you don't think it's going to result in the beneficial types of consequences that's being argued, and you start to critique the view that certain spokespeople for these groups have, you will be pushed out of the universities, because it is basically being demanded now that you must accept this. And if you don't accept these ideas, then you are seen as an oppressive person and a person who is, well, off now you're, people are being called white supremacists. So you're seen as a white supremacist, which is absolutely, for people who are not used to being called these names, that is a very upsetting thing, to have someone else think of you as a white supremacist. And myself, like I have no attachment whatsoever to any white kind of idea of white supremacy. I want everyone to be equal into society. I want everyone to have access to whatever it is that they need. But at the same time, I think that we need to be understand, we have to have an understanding of what the truth is before we can actually work towards what will make a better society. And with wokeism, you're just stopped at every turn, because it is this position that this is the view that must be accepted. And historically, identity politics existed with other, you know, ways of thinking about things, and no one was demanding that you accept the identity politics position. Now it's basically being demanded that you must accept it. So that's where we're at. So in the university system, I'm really noticing the parallelist position is very strong, and you're really not able to argue against it anymore. In terms of how things are in the communities, it's hard to say. because you don't really get to talk to ordinary people in the communities. What you do is you get to see the chiefs at the Assembly of First Nations and the various spokespeople, but you don't really get a very good sense of what is happening to your typical Indigenous person living in one of these remote communities.
So you're suggesting that as a researcher going into these communities to discuss these issues, you don't get to speak to the rank and file so much as you do as you speak with the leaders? Is this what I'm hearing you say?
And it's actually it's more complicated than that. What's happened now is because of wokeism and all the various controls that exist, there's actually been research ethics protocols that have been developed, which say that you've got to have a special kind of ethical stance when you're dealing with Indigenous people. And if you're doing research in an Indigenous community, you should not be able to publish anything that is not agreed to by the community. So you often have to sign these agreements when you're going into those communities. This has made it very, very difficult to study things like fetal alcohol syndrome in Indigenous communities, which is my understanding, although we don't have any data on this now. It was quite bad 20 years ago, and I'm sure it's worse, especially in the remote communities, is that there are, you know, 30%, 40% of the population we have fetal alcohol syndrome because of, you know, and it's nothing to do with the individuals. It's got to do with a, you know, sort of a culture of hopelessness that comes when you're dependent, when you don't, you aren't a productive member and you actually don't see yourself as, you know, producing value within society. This leads to hopelessness, which then leads to all sorts of substance abuse, which then leads to fetal alcohol syndrome. Anyway, we need to figure out how to deal with this very, very serious, catastrophic problem. But because research is really, really restrained in that area, we're not going to have a very good understanding of that. So it's those kinds of issues and just generally trying to understand what's going on in communities, which is very, very difficult now because of these research protocols that are in place that you can't really, come to any conclusions that aren't vetted by the leadership of that community.
Okay, I see that our time is running out right now, but I'd like to continue this conversation. I'm as a newbie, as an individual who's trying to understand, and I'm sure a lot of people in this country are also trying to understand exactly what our responsibilities are as a country with respect to ensuring that everyone is able to flourish. It seems to me that we need to allow for further discussion on these matters. I want to get into this situation you find yourself in presenting your ideas and how it is that you have become canceled in certain areas, certain universities and so forth. And you also lost your position, I understand. So we want to dig into those issues as well, trying to make sense of this, trying to understand what's been happening. Is there any final comment that you would like to make right now as we close this section of our discussion?
Well, I think it's important to point to the fact that almost everyone who I talk to is very, very concerned about Indigenous people. What's the problem with wokeism is that it basically uses the deprived circumstances of groups to sort of impose its totalitarian position. So it says that that you cannot really help members of society unless you clamp down on speech. And that sort of, and it uses these members of these oppressed groups to, you know, sort of make those demands on institutions like universities. So we really have to come to an understanding that the truth is not opposed to the thriving of any group. It's the truth that enables us to help groups that are not doing very well in society. So kind of disentangling those particular characteristics, I think, is very, very important in trying to fight back against what's called wokeism in universities and also in the rest of society.
Okay. Well, it seems like we've got a lot more to talk about. So where can people find information about your work? And I'm assuming you're on social media.
Yes, I am. So the place where I post most of my materials current is on my Facebook page, which you can find very easily. And I'm covering a whole bunch of different issues at this time. And then a website has been developed about my circumstances as well, www.wokeacademy.info. So that has a lot of information about the various things. I'm also a board member for the Society for Academic Freedom and Scholarship and have written several articles in their newsletter, and also wrote, I believe, 9 articles for a journal called Minding the Campus, which is the journal of the National Association of Scholars, which is an organization protecting academic freedom and scholarly standards in the United States.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you so much. And stay with us as we continue on our conversation. And I want to thank you, our viewers, for taking the time to listen to Dr. Whittison as she's shared with us her experience, but there's a lot more to come. So stay tuned for the next segment. And I want to thank you, even though you may agree or disagree with my guests or myself on these matters and other matters that we discuss here on Freedom Feature, but we want to have open, honest, and transparent dialogue. And until next time, I'm Barry Bussey. The fight for freedom consists not only in the legal battles in court, but also in the battle of ideas at the universities and in the media. It takes time, effort, and money to keep on top of the debates for freedom. Your donation allows us to keep fighting for all Canadians. firstfreedoms.ca